This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the program today, a little bit of budget policy. Well, more than a little bit. Some Russia, too. And then drones from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 9th of March. Glad you could be here, everybody, with the full realization that some not small percentage of you are listening to this while in a car or on a train or a subway and or do so on a daily basis and so are well aware of what I'm about to say. I nonetheless do need to say it. This country's infrastructure stinks, like just this side of a failing grade stinks. The American Society of Civil Engineers came out with its annual infrastructure report card today, D plus overall. Let me say that again, D plus. President Trump has promised to do something about it. A public-private partnership is what he wants, in which $150 or so billion dollars of tax incentives is going to generate, the White House hopes, $1 trillion worth of infrastructure investment. But as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, that public-private thing is going to affect the kinds of things that get built.
Toll roads are an easy sell. There's tangible return on investment. Kevin D. Good is director of infrastructure policy at the Center for American Progress. He says the problem is that some of the projects that need investment aren't moneymakers. Think of that stretch of rural highway in West Texas.
Those projects are not likely to find any benefit or likely to be moved to implementation with a tax credit and public-private partnership scheme just because the math doesn't work out for those investors.
But ultimately, it's not the business paying for the project anyway.
The users pay for these systems.
Greg DiLoretto is the chair of the civil engineers who came up with America's infrastructure grade.
Whether it's through a tax, whether it's through a water bill or a power bill, the users pay for it. So however you capitalize it and fund it, we still have to pay that money back.
One more problem, we don't have the labor force to get a lot of these things done. Andy Whitman is an engineering and construction analyst at R.W. Baird.
This is a different skill set, and there's a shortage of people, and you can even see a little bit of inflation in the broad-based construction cost indices as well.
Kevin D. Good at the Center for American Progress says galvanizing the public to get behind funding boring infrastructure projects that we take for granted is tough, too.
We tend to focus on really big dollar projects. We tend to focus on these mega projects. But I think when we do that, we miss the fact that so much of what is needed is basic repair of what already exists and incremental improvements.
Incremental improvements would certainly help and might even produce something better than a D+. The infrastructure grade this time around was the same as it was 4 years ago. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The Washington Post got its hands on some preliminary White House budget documents for the Department of Housing and Urban Development in particular. Looks like a cut of about $6 billion is in the offing. That would be HUD's contribution to the big bump that the Pentagon is going to get. Funding for housing vouchers and repairing public housing is said to be in the crosshairs. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that one.
A possible 14% reduction in HUD's budget is causing consternation for officials in places like New York City, the country's largest provider of affordable housing.
Public housing in New York City is so financially and physically fragile that it cannot safely absorb the shock of a 14% reduction in HUD's overall budget.
Richie Torres chairs the committee overseeing the New York City Housing Authority. HUD may reportedly cut funds for repairs at public housing facilities by a third, or $1.3 billion. Torres says that could cause public health hazards.
You have residents who are living in molded and leaking conditions.
The Washington Post says funding for rental assistance programs like Section 8 vouchers would be held flat in 2018, despite spikes in rents and family homelessness in some cities. But Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute says HUD funding for things like vouchers doesn't actually help the impoverished.
It tends to concentrate poverty in certain parts of cities and tends to trap low-income tenants in these often substandard buildings.
He'd rather incent private developers to build affordable housing by removing barriers like zoning restrictions. Carol Galante at UC Berkeley was a federal housing official under the Obama administration. She says the private market alone can't meet the demand for affordable housing.
That is not going to get us to helping someone who can only afford $400 or $500 a month rent.
The Trump administration has said it will release its complete budget plan next week. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Up arrows for all three major indices today by the hairs on their chinny chin chins. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The relationship of the Trump White House to Russia, which we note for the record here the president says doesn't exist, seems to be complicated. It's a mixture of media and the use of it, economics and the promises made about it, and nationalism and its potential and perils. Peter Pomerantsev is a fellow at the London School of Economics. His book about the Russian propaganda machine is called Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
When you were writing your book about what was happening in Russia and the media and all of that, what was it like there in the economy? You know, what was the feel?
Well, I was there from 2001 to 2010, actually living there. It was the oil boom. Russia was just becoming incredibly wealthy, very, very fast. I mean, people were becoming super rich, but also ordinary people were becoming richer than they ever had been in Russia's history. They couldn't afford, you know, cars and Western holidays and mortgages and all those terrible things. But Moscow, where I was living, I mean, that was just, you know, there was just this boom where people seemed to be becoming sort of billionaires in the blink of an eye. And not just you know, because they were somehow related to the state and all sorts of business and IT and TV and advertising. So it was incredibly exciting. It felt like, you know, Jazz Age New York or Elizabethan London.
And so what's the compare and contrast to today or whenever the last time you were there was?
Well, I mean, I visit regularly. I mean, I was also there during the financial crash, so 2008, when that bubble really deflated. Though I have to say, Russians took it much better than Westerners. And Westerners were all having nervous breakdowns over the financial crash. And Russians were like, you call this a financial crash? You know, they'd been through so much in the last 20 years. Where, you know, even the richest people had to queue for milk at some point. So actually, Russians took it much more in their stride than Westerners did. But that kind of boom stopped. And that sense of, you know, being able to earn anything at any point, that went away. And, you know, the government had to adapt its politics.
Trump is or claims to be a billionaire. And yet he says he fights for the common man in this country. And clearly that has worked. Does Putin do the same thing over there?
Very much so. So Putin will define his enemies, or certainly did when he came to power, define his enemies as the oligarchs. Just like Trump, he plays on this idea of sort of an elite in Moscow, which is all cosmopolitan and therefore not like the common man. And he is, of course, with the common man. So that's a game they both play, and both have very successfully framed their opposition as, you know, globalist, cosmopolitan, all these words that they both kind of indulge in. You know, I suppose I would be a member of this metropolitan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think we tend to actually end up playing their game and mirroring this frame back at them. And I think one has to be very, very careful not to sort of like, you know, reflect these divisions that suit these leaders.
Get me to the economic truth of this for a second, though, because what's happening in this country, in America, for the past decades has been a widening income gap and wealth disparity and the rich getting richer and the poor not getting by. And we saw that in this election. In Russia, I imagine it's very much the same thing, although the stratification, the layers might be more clearly defined, right, with the poor staying poor and the very rich elite profiting and Putin capitalizing on that.
Well, everyone got richer in Russia during the 2000s. This is the thing. Everybody was allowed their sort of various slices of the pie, whether you were a cop on the streets being corrupt and taking bribes, that was okay as long as you were loyal to the Kremlin, all the way up to the top where like the oligarchs could steal as much as they like as long as they were being loyal. So it was kind of corruption for loyalty. And the cleverness of the system is that everyone ends up corrupt. In America, there is, I think, a gap, not just financial, but also, you know, in a way, I don't know, psychological. As I was in Iowa, I watched TV a lot. And what was very noticeable was that it seemed to be a bunch of New Yorkers talking to themselves about themselves, making jokes that they understood with absolutely no relationship to Iowans. And I think American media may have made a little bit of a mistake here. It's created a gap. So it's all about being relevant. I mean, I think it can be a spiritual gap as much as a financial gap.
Okay, so spitball for me for a minute. Look in your crystal ball. The economic movement and the nationalist, globalist, whatever the movement you want to call that Putin has started in Russia has gone on for, God, what, 15 years now. What's your sense of the movement that President Trump has started in this country and its duration?
I don't think it's a movement the way that they would like to portray. I think there might be an overarching moment, and we see this throughout the world, of wanting to tell the people who've been in charge to, I mean, F off. You know, a moment where you can express yourself. I don't see a kind of like a 1930s type movement emerging at the moment. That doesn't mean it might not emerge, because sometimes if you say these things, they become true and you know, the movement will appear. But at the moment, I still think there's actually a gap in between the rhetoric and the reality. Having said that, there is, we do see these parties emerging throughout Europe who have managed to capitalize on one theme, really, which is immigration, and who have normalized racism, essentially. And that is a very, very disturbing thing, because they're normalizing sort of hate speech and violence, and we don't know where that will end up. When you let those demons out, it's unclear where they end up.
Peter Pomerantsev, he's a senior visiting fellow at the London School of Economics. His book on Russian propaganda is called Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. Peter, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
For the first time in 65 years, actors at a major television network have held a union vote. Stars of the wildly popular telenovelas aired on NBC Universal's Telemundo are going to be joining SAG-AFTRA, the Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of Television Radio Artists, in case you're curious. They do so in the hopes of getting better pay, health insurance, and overtime. But all of that is going to mean higher costs for somebody. Sally Herships reports.
Pablo Azar is a Telemundo star. He's got blonde hair and green eyes, and there are a lot of beefcakey pictures of him on the internet.
So people imagine that we are like a Hollywood star and that we live like them.
Nope. Last year, Azar finished filming a telenovela, La Fan, but...
But after the novella, I have to, make a living. Sometimes I drive for Uber.
In addition to driving when he's not on set, Azar also runs his own art gallery and designs T-shirts. Jonathan Handel is a contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter.
Actors in telenovelas, actors in Spanish language media generally, have not been paid anywhere near the rates that actors in English language media are paid.
Because telenovelas air at night and English soaps air during the day, it's hard to compare pay rates. But Handel estimates Spanish language actors earn less than half of their English unionized counterparts.
Unlike the drama in telenovelas that is probably a little overblown, that the drama here really rests on real world concerns.
Like getting health insurance, overtime pay, and critically in today's Netflix world, royalties. Tom Geyer is managing editor at The Wrap.
Because there's now a shelf life, there's now a market for that programming long after it was recorded.
NBC Universal owns Telemundo. It says the vote still needs to be certified. It says it's disappointed, but will move forward with negotiations. As for Azar, you can see him on TV tonight. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I couldn't envision going across the border when my Muslim friends can't.
Immigration policy and economic reality straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The bull market turned 8 today. Think back to March of 2009, but there wasn't much of a party on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials basically flat, picked up just 2 points, closed at 20,858. Ditto for the NASDAQ, which added a single point, 5,838. The S&P 500 also ticked up a point, just under a tenth percent, 23.64. Financials were in a happier mood. Citigroup advanced 0.75%. Morgan Stanley stepped up 0.2%. Today, crude oil continued its slide down below $50 a barrel for the first time this year. Energy stocks, it didn't care a whit. ExxonMobil up 0.75%. Occidental Petroleum took home an extra 0.7%. Facebook, which wasn't even public when this bull market started, up 0.33%. Snap, which wasn't even public when this month started, reverse 0.4%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.60%. You're listening to Marketplace. All this month, we're asking you to tell a friend about a podcast they are going to love. Right now, think of a friend, your mom, or anybody you care about. What podcast would they really, really like to hear?
All right, you got that person in your head. Now go do it. Tell them about it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know about podcasts, show them how to download them. Please tell us what you recommended with the hashtag TryPod. That's T-R-Y pod. And thanks for spreading the word.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today from the desk of, yeah, they're great fun till somebody gets hurt, consumer drones. Even apart from people flying them who shouldn't be or flying them where they shouldn't be, there are rising concerns about drones being used for terrorism. So both government agencies and private companies are developing technologies to keep drones at bay. Doug Starr has been reporting on the budding anti-drone industry for Wired Magazine. Doug, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Tell me about the company you focus on in this piece. Black Sage, it's called, out of Idaho, right?
Yeah. Black Sage is one of a growing handful of companies that's devoting their resources to tracking and disabling errant drones.
What is the threat that this – it's a growing industry, right? What's the threat it is designed to counter?
Well, first of all, the number of drones that proliferate is huge. It's over a million, and it's growing by multiples each year. This happened ever since 2013 when the big Chinese drone maker DJI produced the first consumer drones, and they just took off like crazy. So part of the problem is that there are so many, and they are kind of piloted by just hobbyists, so they end up in places where they shouldn't be, like near airports, near stadiums, and it's dangerous. There have been a lot of near misses with airliners. Last spring, one even bonked off a British airliner going into London. So they've got to get under control.
And there's a more serious threat, too, right? I mean, ISIS is using these. The Pentagon has put out like a $20 million contract.
Yeah, they've seen ISIS begin to use consumer-grade drones to spy and drop small explosives on people in the Middle East. And people here are being alert. The military has been conducting, and the FAA have been conducting a lot of tests all over the country to try to come up with systems to track and control drones. And there's even an organization called the National Center for Spectator Sports Safety and Security.
Wow.
That's alerting stadium operators to the possible danger of drones.
Man. You went on a sort of a test run of the anti-drone stuff with Black Sage. What was it like?
It was fascinating. We were sitting in a trailer that served as a command center. Their assistant flew a drone out about a kilometer beyond where we could see it. They have a radar system that shows the drone as a blip, but then it uses artificial intelligence to say, what are the chances this could be a drone as opposed to a bird? And then this high-def camera locks into it, and it can't get away. And then when it comes in sight, one of the guys pushed a button, and that shot a burst of radio wave jamming at it, and it paralyzed the thing.
But as you point out in the piece, if they did that like in the middle of L.A. or New York or something, everybody in the path of that beam loses their Wi-Fi.
This is what makes the problem so interesting. It's illegal to use jamming equipment in the U.S. Yeah. It has been since 1934 when the first FCC laws were passed. Huh. So the problem is, what do you do about this? Right. Here's a case where the regulations are lagging behind the technology that we need.
What's interesting about these Black Sage guys is that they were, even with you, a person they came to trust, I suppose, to some degree, they were a little bit cat and mouse, right? Because they don't want to let the drone guys know what their anti-drone capabilities are.
there's a kind of a spy versus spy element to this. And it was fun because every once in a while, out of the blue, I'd get a call saying, okay, I'm somewhere in the Middle East. It's really hot. We just had a successful demonstration for a bunch of guys in the Royal Guard of a country I can't name. And I would just get these updates from there. It was fascinating. It's interesting, the way they put it, it's a very interesting concept. They say that security has gone from a two-dimensional problem to a three-dimensional problem.
Oh, yeah.
So you could have a stadium and have the metal detectors and everything you want, invest millions, and a $500 drone could fly in over your head.
Wow. Doug Starr is the co-director of the graduate program in science journalism at Boston University. His piece on drones is available in the new issue of Wired magazine. Doug, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
This is not perhaps going to be surprising, but after years of growth, industry predictions for the number of international visitors coming to the United States are down this year a lot, nearly 2 million fewer people, with a cost to businesses of almost $2.5 billion. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra has more on that story.
One of the spots tourists flock to in New York City is Grand Central Station. You'll often find them in the main concourse, craning their necks to look at the green ceiling dotted with tiny golden stars, or standing on the marble staircase looking down as hundreds of New Yorkers run to catch their trains. That's where I found 29-year-old Luis Bichada and 30-year-old Vitor Saiki from Brazil, taking selfies. Saiki said they'd just gotten to New York.
We're going to stay here for 5 more days, and then we're going to Boston, and then we go back to Brazil.
Bichada said they flew to the United States on a Mexican airline, and having heard President Trump's stance on Mexico and his call for tighter immigration rules, they were a little worried.
We don't know how we're going to people in the immigration center will receive us. So, but it was okay. They made some questions, but it was normal.
Bichada says now they're glad they came, but it looks like some people may not take that chance. Adam Sachs is president of Tourism Economics, a travel research firm. He says the latest data shows that flight bookings, travel searches, and other indicators of interest in U.S. travel have dropped.
And so all of these together are painting this picture of a shift in travel patterns away from the U.S.
One factor could be the strong dollar, but Sachs says the political environment is a bigger issue. Based on his research, he attributes the drop to Trump's America First rhetoric, his talk about a border wall with Mexico, the travel ban, the notion of extreme vetting.
It conveys a position of unwelcoming, and so that's affecting potential travelers.
Some of those travelers are worried they'll pay for airfare, hotels, and everything else, and then they won't be allowed into the country. Nikolai Chen Nielsen is 30, and he's a Brazilian-Danish citizen working as a consultant for McKinsey in Dubai. He talked to me from overseas. He and his wife were planning to visit friends in the U.S. this summer.
We had all the dates planned.
But Nielsen's wife is a Swedish-Iranian citizen, and with the travel ban, they don't know if they'll be allowed in. He says a round-trip ticket from Dubai could cost $1,500.
The whole notion of planning a summer holiday and getting that canceled, that's the biggest impediment for me. Then I'd rather use the week visiting friends somewhere else in Europe or visiting my family in Denmark.
Other travelers are staying home as a form of protest. Grant Hader-Menzies is 52. He's a Canadian-American citizen and an author, and he'd been planning a book tour through the U.S. From his apartment in Vancouver, he tells me he canceled the trip.
I couldn't do it. I couldn't envision going across the border when my Muslim friends can't.
Cities like New York, which brought in 12.7 million international visitors last year, are taking any potential drop in tourism seriously. Right now, the city's expecting 300,000 fewer foreign travelers in 2017 and estimates that'll cost about $600 million in lost sales. Fred Dixon is CEO of the city's tourism marketing agency, NYC & Company.
Every day people are making decisions about where they're going to go. And if they choose, you know, not to pick New York for their 2017 holiday, you know, we'll have to wait and try to get them again next year.
NYC and Company is rolling out what it calls the New York City Welcoming the World marketing campaign in the UK, Mexico, Germany, and other countries.
It was very important for us to remind people that if you do come to New York, you're going to have a great time.
First, the city has to convince people to come. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
final note on the way out today, class is in session. Speaker of the House Paul Ryan held what can only be called a seminar today, how he sees the healthcare debate and why the GOP is doing what it's doing as it repeals and tries to replace the Affordable Care Act. I'm not kidding, by the way, when I say seminar. Picture Ryan in rolled up shirt sleeves, a PowerPoint deck he was running through. Here's just a bit of the tape.
So take a look at this chart. The red slice here are what I would call people with pre-existing conditions, people who have real healthcare problems. The blue is the rest of the people in the individual market. That's the market where people don't get health insurance at their jobs, where they buy it themselves. The whole idea of Obamacare is the people on the blue side pay for the people on the red side. The people who are healthy pay for the people who are sick. It's not working, and that's why it's in a death spiral.
Thing is, Mr. Speaker, that's exactly the way insurance works. All right, we got to go. The markets have been going up for 8 years as of today. So on this day, they took a break flat all the way around. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Christy George, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troh are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.